So first of all, thank you for having me speak here. I'm going to talk about some work that is in progress with Janet Hung, and also based on previous work with William Donnelly. So just a very brief introduction. When we first took a class in quantum field theory, we learned to compute this path integral. And it gives us things like the correlation functions, scattering amplitudes. It can compute topological invariants, and even give us a replicature computation of entanglement entropy. But it's missing a very important ingredient that we care about, which is a factorization of the Hilbert space, a local factorization in space. What I mean by that is the Hilbert space is not canonically expressed as a tensor product of Hilbert spaces attached to little subregions in space. So the basic problem is twofold. If we divide space into little subregions and try to define local operators acting on each Hilbert space, each Hilbert space would have edge modes because the subregions have boundaries. And these edge modes exist even for simple scalar field theory, as these authors showed. Also, the degrees of freedom in each subregion are not entirely independent. There is some correlation because of just continuity in quantum field theory. And in the case of gauge theory, something more subtle, which is a Gauss law constraint that connects degrees of freedom on either side. So this begs the question of how we can define entanglement in a quantum field theory, because the first thing we need to do is to factorize the Hilbert space. So I want to briefly review how this problem was solved in gauge theory. The solution goes under the name of extended Hilbert space. The basic idea is that if I take a gauge theory whose degrees of freedom are really loops, these are the gauge invariant degrees of freedom, like Wilson loops, and I try to cut space into two parts and define Hilbert spaces on either side, I'll necessarily cut some of these closed loops. And the dangling ends of the cut that I make here leaves these dangling endpoints, which are charges, locations where Gauss law is violated. So the best thing I can do if I want to factorize the physical Hilbert space is to embed it into a larger one. In this larger one, I've split the entangling surface into two parts, and I have a Hilbert space on V and a Hilbert space on V bar, both of which have a boundary. And I allow for the existence of edge degrees of freedom on these boundaries. These are like charges living on the boundary where the Wilson lines can end. And these edge modes transform under some boundary symmetry group that I call G times G bar. And now we want to find a subspace of this tensor product where the physical states live. These physical states satisfy Gauss law constraint written as a linear equation like this, which we can view as sort of an equivalence relation. So the physical states are different equivalence classes under this equivalence relation. And we can express the physical Hilbert space not as a regular tensor product, but as some kind of entangling product. I should have referenced here people like William Donnelly and Lauren Ferdow, who defined this kind of tensor product. This G here is denoting the quotient via Gauss's law. And once we embed this physical Hilbert space into this larger factorized Hilbert space, we can define a reduced density matrix and trace out, by tracing out half of the Hilbert space, and then compute things like entanglement entropy. So that's the basic setup of the solution to this factorization problem. The extension I described earlier begs the question, so there are different choices you could have made in extending by adding edge modes. And so it begs the question, what are the right edge modes? What are the rules that determine the edge modes? And in one plus one dimension, Will and I showed that this Hilbert space extension should be thought of as part of the data of an extended topological quantum field theory. The key insight there was we want to think about this entangling product, which fuses together two endpoints of an interval. So here we're in one plus one dimension, so space is just a line or a segment. We want to view the entangling product, instead of happening at a constant time slice, we want to see it as a cobordism, which is this space-time process where two intervals fuses into one. And once we think about this entangling product in terms of this cobordism, this object now lives inside this language of extended quantum field theory that was developed by these authors here. And very briefly, what that formulation of quantum field theory is about is to take our path integral that we know and love on a closed surface, and we start cutting it on surfaces of increasing codimension. So for example, I took a torus here, I cut it along circles. And when I cut along circles, I find a pair of pants and a cap. Extension in this extended QF theory refers to the fact that I don't have to start with a circle. I can take the circle and cut the circle along a point. And that cutting expresses the cobordism, gives us this object we call the zipper. Similarly, a segment can be cut along a point, which gives us two segments, which is sort of an open string version of a pair of pants. And when we do this, we can sort of open up a generic Riemann surface. And if we want to understand the path integral on a generic surface, we can just try to understand the path integral on the basic building blocks, because we can always glue these basic building blocks to give us the total surface. So I want to say just a little bit more about what this extension of a quantum field theory involves. So I'm going to, for this talk, only stick with the case of Euclidean two dimensions. And in that setting, and I'm also going to talk about this TQFT for now. A closed TQFT should be thought of in this formalism as some kind of rule. This rule I call Z because it's basically defined by the path integral. It assigns to a codimension one surface, which is a circle, some kind of a Hilbert space of states. And it takes cobordisms, which are surfaces that interpolate between initial and final circles. It takes those cobordisms and map them to linear maps between the Hilbert spaces of the initial slice and final slice. More generally, we can think of surfaces like these as cobordisms because the initial slice is a point which is an empty set, and that empty set gets, sorry, that's the initial surface should be think of something that it gets mapped to the, it's an empty set and it gets mapped to a state. So this is a cobordism between the empty set and the circle, and that should be thought as mapping to a choice of state in the Hilbert space. This is a cobordism between the empty set and the empty set, and should be thought of as just a number, which is the partition function. The important thing about cobordisms is we can glue them together. And when we glue them together, this rule, the gluing is compatible with a rule in the sense that gluing cobordisms corresponds to composition of linear maps. Now, we can take this closed TQFT and extend it to an open closed TQFT. What we mean by this is we now allow for surfaces with boundaries. So in addition to circles, we also have intervals which have endpoints that are labeled by some boundary conditions, alpha and beta. And so the Hilbert space assigned to this interval would now have two labels, alpha and beta. And similarly, we have cobordisms between intervals. Now all the boundaries have to be labeled. And whenever these sort of open string boundaries meet, they have to have the matching labels. And again, such a cobordism is mapped to a linear map between Hilbert spaces. Now, there is an important cobordism that connects the closed and open sector. It's this thing we call the zipper. It maps the closed Hilbert space, the Hilbert space on a circle, into the Hilbert space of an interval labeled by these boundary conditions alpha. And again, we can compose cobordisms, and that composition corresponds to compositions of linear maps. And just one final comment, these TQFTs have an algebraic structure because the pair of pants, both for the closed and the open string, define some kind of multiplication. So that defines an algebra that's called a Frobenius algebra. So that structure that I just described is not arbitrary. It has to satisfy some consistency equations, because we wanted to cut up a surface a general surface into these basic building blocks, but there are more than one choices of such a cutting. And in order for all those choices of cutting to be compatible, to be consistent, these five rules have to be satisfied. So these are the so-called sewing constraints, sewing relations. And in fact, these were written down by Moore and Siegel, which were trying to ask the question, given a closed string theory, what are the possible boundaries? What are the possible D-rings? And for them, the answer is that a D-ring corresponds to an extension of a closed string algebra into an open string algebra. And that extension is defined by this pair of pants object with these boundary labels that correspond to D-rings. So in the story that Will and I were talking about, we introduce an extra relation called the E-ring axiom. It tells us that essentially that holes opened up by entangling surface can be closed up. And so we can reformulate their sort of thinking in the following way. We're starting with a closed theory, which is our quantum field theory, say, with Hilbert space on a circle. And our Hilbert space extension should be thought of as an extension of the closed string algebra in the circle into an open string algebra, where the boundaries have a special label we call E. E corresponds to this entanglement brain boundary condition that I'll say more about, which allows you to close up holes. Are there any questions so far? So just one more slide about the E-brain boundary condition. As I mentioned earlier, it's a boundary condition designed so that holes that are opened up due to the splitting of an interval into two, say, can be closed up, because this is splitting that is associated with the factorization of a Hilbert space. And in that factorization, there's not a real boundary that we're introducing. It's an entanglement boundary, sort of a boundary that really isn't there. And the one comment I want to make is that this boundary condition doesn't have to be, it's not necessarily local. In fact, in gauge theory, we know that it's actually a superposition of local boundary conditions. As an example, in Yang-Mills theory, in two-dimensional Yang-Mills, this boundary condition corresponds to putting a trivial holonomy on these circular boundaries. And that's not local from the point of view of this open string that's moving around in a loop. But this sort of closing up the whole axiom is a basic constraint on our theory that comes from basically the definition of the reduced density matrix. The idea is that if we start with a system on a circle and we compute correlation functions on it, we can compare that computation of correlation functions on, say, half the circle to the correlation functions computed in the reduced density matrix, rho v, that I get from reducing to that half of the circle. And those two sets of correlation functions should agree. That requires these holes to be filled. So that was a story that I told about a year ago in this very room. And now I want to extend this story to conformal field theories. In fact, Lavellin in 92, which predates Moore-Siegel, actually formulated what he would call boundary CFT, but what I'm calling open-closed CFT, in terms of sewing axioms, very much like Moore-Siegel, or actually it predates Moore-Siegel. So for example, these are different ways of slicing a closed ring road sheet, and these different slicings correspond to crossing symmetry, and this is modular invariance here. Similarly, these different slicings of open closed string road sheets are basically a conformal field theory version of the Moore-Siegel axioms that I showed earlier. So it's natural to ask, can we do the same thing that we did with GQFT? Can we talk about extended Hilbert space in CFT? What are the edge nodes? What's the entanglement brain boundary condition? And is there some kind of cobordism description of factorization? Actually, any questions so far? Okay. So now I want to give, I'm not going to give some kind of technical description of what extended quantum field theory is. In fact, as far as I know, I'm not sure there's an accepted an accepted rigorous version of extended conformal field theory in the literature. But I want to go through the basic objects and tell you, roughly speaking, what a CFT should assign to them. Beginning with the circle, this is something we probably are all familiar with. A CFT assigns a local Hilbert space to a circle in the following sense. If I take this circle, I can prepare any state on it by doing a path integral on a very long cylinder. And if I insert a primary state at minus infinity, it will prepare a state I want at the circle at time equals zero. And because of conformal invariance, we can map the cylinder to a disk with a puncture in the middle. So that's how we prepare the Hilbert space of a CFT on a circle. And it's important that this can be done on any circle locally on a Riemann surface, right? For example, in the pair of Pan's geometry, there are three different circles, so there are three different Hilbert spaces. The primary state we inserted here is the highest weight state. And on top of that primary, there's an entire representation of the Virchow algebra. In this case, in this talk, I'm going to assume also there's an extended symmetry, there's a Kac-Moody symmetry. What that means is that there's some conserved current. I've written for the case of a U1 current, Jn, which satisfies Kac-Moody algebra. And all of the states that we build on this primary can be expressed in terms of raising and lowering operators that we get from the negative modes of this algebra. So we have a Hilbert space assigned to your circle that gives a representation of some Kac-Moody algebra. And now we also have a closed ring pair of Pants here, which roughly speaking corresponds to the OP coefficients. More precisely, in a CFT, this pair of Pants should be described in some particular conformal frame, which I've chosen here. This is a plane with three holes. So there are three punctures, one at zero, one at z, and one at infinity. And I've inserted primaries I, j, k there. So this object, which is really this pair of Pants here, should be thought of as this chiral vertex operator. What it does is it's a mapping between the Hilbert space on these two circles, I, j, onto the Hilbert space on this big circle labeled by k. And in fact, that mapping is just given by the OP coefficients. The C, I, j, k really is the OP coefficient that appears when you take an operator I and j close together. Questions? So we can extend what we said to the open case. When we have an open CFT, we have to consider an interval. And again, we can prepare a state from minus infinity. The difference now is that the interval has labelings A and B. So we have to put some boundary conditions there. And now we can, I'll say more about these boundary conditions in the next slide. They're going to be conformally invariant boundary conditions. And we can now prepare a state. But instead of mapping this to a full disk, we're going to map it to half of the disk. And the insertions are appearing at the center here. And the primaries now have some labeling AB corresponding to the boundary condition on either side of this puncture. These are also otherwise known as boundary condition changing operators, because as you cross this point on the real line, you switch from boundary condition A to B. We also have an open string version of the pair of Pants. This time we have more labels because in addition to IJK, we have the boundary conditions ABC. And again, we choose the standard conformal frame, where this is mapped to an upper half plane. And we choose the three punctures to be at zero, x, and infinity. And again, this cobordism should be thought of really as represented by a OP coefficient. Now, these are boundary to boundary OP coefficients that tell you the OP of two boundary operators I and j when you bring them close together. And finally, we have the zipper. The zipper is an object that should be mapped to this this upper half plane again with the closed string state that we start with being inserted in the bulk at some point z. The zipper is going to map a closed string to an open string state. And we should think of that as a bulk to boundary OPE. When you bring this bulk point close to the boundary, it can be expressed as a sum of boundary operators. that connect boundary condition A and A. And this cobordism is expressed now by this bulk to boundary OP coefficient with some z dependence here. Questions? Okay. Now I want to say more about the boundary condition, the boundary labelings A and B. So these are conformal boundary conditions. What does that mean? It means that the stress tensor and the cosmodic current should satisfy this condition that T of z equals T bar of z bar along the real axis here of the z plane. And similarly for the cosmodic, except there could be a plus minus sign here in the case of U1 cosmodic corresponding to Dirichlet or Neumann boundary conditions. So what's useful about this boundary condition is, well, first of all, it's conformally invariant, so it's going to preserve half of the Virasoro cosmodic symmetries. But one nice interpretation we can have is that it allows you to extend the boundary CFT from the upper half plane into the lower half by doing an unfolding trick. The point is that because this condition allows you to analytically continue T of z down to the lower half plane, we can set T of z in the lower half plane to be T bar in the conjugate point on the upper half plane. And similarly for J, and what this means is that this theory, we can think of it rather than having both left and right moving parts in the upper half plane. We can just think of it as living on the whole plane, but with only, say, a right moving part. And in particular, an open string pair of pants like this can be unfolded into a closed string pair of pants. And more precisely, when I said that, so I mentioned that this preserves half the symmetry generators. So the symmetry generators are written here. This is written in the language of the upper half plane, or the half of the disk, where these contour integrals are integrated over the semicircle here. But when we unfold, we can just do a single integral over the entire circle of a single right moving stress tensor. And similarly for the Kasputi current. And now, once we do this unfolding, the tower of states that is built upon this primary can be expressed just like in the closed string case. We just have these JNs, these raising and lowering operators that build the entire representation of a cosmic algebra. So there's something. So here we have this talked about some kind of extension of the closed string, closed CFT to the open CFT. But it's not quite the extension we want, because if I want to imagine this is some kind of factorization as I go from the bottom to the upper slices, it looks like that here, starting with an interval that has nothing going on in the middle, when I moved up to the top, suddenly I've introduced a label. And that's not what we think of as factorization. It seems to introduce something at the entangling surface. So now I want to introduce our proposal for an entanglement brain boundary condition, which is sort of a boundary condition that doesn't insert some object at the entangling surface. So it's particularly concise to describe this boundary condition in the closed string channel. What I mean is that now I consider this open string here, and I consider a one loop diagram, this annulus. And I think about the closed string channel, meaning I think about this as an evolution from the closed string in the middle boundary of this annulus to the outside boundary. And when I think this way, I can describe the conformally invariant boundary condition A and B in terms of the closed string Hilbert space on these circles. In fact, they satisfy these equations. The condition that T of z equals T bar of z bar corresponds to this condition with the Virasoro algebra, defined for the closed string, which is why I put the upper script C here. And similarly for the Kasmudi algebra. And these conformally invariant boundary conditions have solutions that are called the Ishibashi state. There's one such solution for each primary, each bulk primary of the CFT. And it is some kind of entangled state between the left and the right moving part of this closed string Hilbert space here. And our proposal is simply that what we call the entanglement brain state is just the Ishibashi state in the vacuum sector with h equal to 0. And among other things, this boundary condition is going to satisfy this closing up of holes requirement I mentioned earlier. But we're going to say a little more precisely in a conformal field theory, what I mean by a hole being closed up is that if I, say, take a CFT on a sphere and I have a hole here of size epsilon, the entanglement brain boundary condition is such that if I compute the correlation functions by CFT in the bulk here, and take the limit as epsilon goes to zero, I recover the bulk correlators that don't know anything about the bound. So this is sort of what I mean in a CFT when I say a hose can be closed up. But I want to make an important point, which is that these Ishibashi states, or this vacuum Ishibashi state, doesn't satisfy a Cardi condition, which is a condition that is needed to make this a local boundary condition. So in general, as in a gauge theory, this Ishibashi state, when we interpret in the open string channel, is not going to be a single local boundary condition, but the sum over different boundary conditions.
The n that you're summing over is labeling what?
So n is going to be over all the excitation. So h is labeling the primary, and n is all the states to build upon that primary. So it will be all the levels and the oscillator numbers. Right, so it's some kind of coherent state here that it's sort of entangled between the left and right. And I should say, it roughly has a look of something like a thermal field double, which is not exactly a coincidence. So I want to say a bit more about this E-brain boundary condition to give an example for the free compact boson. So this is a theory of a scalar field that lives on a circle and target space of radius r. And particularly the zero-mode sector labeled by the left and right moving momenta, which we can write in terms of these quantum numbers. M is a momentum, and n is a winding number. So the Ishibashi states in this case, as I mentioned earlier, are some kind of coherent states. So the Ishibashi states are, again, labeled by these momentum and winding numbers, and they're of this form. I'm not going to go into too much detail about the form of these boundary states. I just want to make the point that if I want to write down local boundary conditions, rather than taking these Ishibashi states, I have to sum over them to give me the Cardi boundary states. These states satisfy the Cardi boundary condition, which I think that I have to go all the way back to this slide to show you. This object here is the Cardi boundary condition. So what it should be is if you cap off the top with this little cap and the bottom with this little cap, this object becomes an annulus, and then this object becomes a cylinder. So the Cardi condition is saying that I can think of a cylinder as either a one-loop open string or a closed string amplitude. But it's an important condition to satisfy to give us a local boundary condition. And you can see that these Cardi boundary states are some kind of sum, a superposition, of these Ishibashi states. There are two types, there's a Neumann and Dirichlet. And each type has a labeling. The Dirichlet has a labeling phi, which is precisely the Dirichlet boundary condition you put on this on your scalar field phi. Now, the Neumann has another labeling, which is a bit obscure in this frame. We're just going to call it a Wilson line, and I'll say a little bit more about that later. But I just want to just give an explicit example of our Ishibashi state in the vacuum sector, which is just these Ishibashi states with the quantum numbers set to zero. But you can see there are two ways of getting them. One is to integrate over all Dirichlet Cardi states of different phi epsilon, or you can integrate over all Wilson line, all Neumann boundary states with some Wilson line W. And the point is that, so why are we integrating over boundary conditions? There are a couple of reasons. One is, if I imagine that I'm doing a path integral on this plane, and I have an entanglement boundary here, it's sort of a boundary that wasn't really there. If I didn't do the entangling split, then the path integral would sum over all values of phi along this circle. So that's an intuitive reason for why the entanglement boundary condition should be one where you sum over the Dirichlet slate. The other reason is that this theory has a shift invariance. This is free compact boson, so phi is invariant under arbitrary shifts by constant. But fixing a Dirichlet boundary condition certainly violates that symmetry. So if we want an entanglement boundary condition to preserve the symmetry, we really have to sum over Dirichlet boundary conditions. So I want to say a bit more about what that sum means in the open string sort of point of view and the result for the entanglement entropy. So this is our proposal for this Dirichlet extension to open strings. We now consider, say, for the zipper, it maps the closed string Hilbert space to the open string Hilbert space, the sum over boundary conditions. This is what I called phi epsilon in the previous slide, but now it's called phi zero. And similarly for this open pair of pants. And we can ask basically the simplest question we ask in entanglement. We just take the ground state on the circle, which is represented by this cap. And we want to cut the circle in half by first splitting the circle into an interval, and then splitting the interval into two intervals. So you can do some simple sequence of moves, and you can see that this geometry is actually equivalent to this one, which is, I guess I would call this a macaroni geometry with entanglement brain boundary conditions on the inner and outer semicircle. And now let's actually calculate this cobordism. This cobordism is supposed to give us the factorization of a vacuum state on the circle. So we have to compute the path integral on this geometry, and we have to add some dimensions because this is a CFT, not a TQFT. So let's say we put a small epsilon cutoff for this small semicircle, and lambda is the radius at the large semicircle. We're going to put Dirichlet boundary conditions, phi epsilon and phi lambda there. And to compute the vacuum wave functional, we have to put some configurations L and R here, and just compute the path integral with those fixed boundary conditions. So in this geometry, because of the circular, the rotational invariance, it's easier to map using the log function to this rectangular strip. So the right side now is in the bottom, and the left side is on top. The angular direction here is the up and down direction, which I call T, and the horizontal is X. And now our zero mode sector expansion of a scalar field with Dirichlet boundary conditions emits two zero modes. There's this phi zero, which lives inside, it's a circular coordinate, and there's a phi one that can be arbitrary, any row number. And these two zero modes are simply related, linearly related to our phi epsilon and phi lambda. So when you do this path integral, because it's a classical, it's a free theory, you can just do a semi-classical calculation. And that path integral gives us the ground state factorized in this way. The amplitude here is just exponential of the minus on shell action on this geometry. And you can see from the point of, just from the form of this, this tensor product, you can see there's entanglement here because the phi epsilon here matches the phi epsilon there. Phi lambda matches phi lambda there. That's just a very simple way in which the entanglement of the state reproduces the geometry here, because this macaroni here really came from this circle. So this circle here was split into two intervals so that the boundary conditions on the intervals have to match. And the main point I want to make is that when we use this entanglement brain boundary condition, there's a sum over Dirichlet boundary conditions. And that sum, when we compute the entanglement entropy, leads to an extra term. So how do we compute the entanglement entropy? We first compute the trace of the density reduced density matrix raised to some power beta over 2 pi. And beta is going to be a parameter we differentiate with respect to get the entropy. The zero mode sector of this partition function, which is really just the annulus diagram, now has an integral over the zero modes I call phi zero and phi one here. And when you do this integral and you compute the entanglement entropy, you find that there's a leading log lambda over epsilon, which we know about. But there's also a subleading term. The subleading term has been discussed before in the literature. It's sometimes called the Affleck-Ludwig boundary entropy. But in this case, what I want to point out is this term really comes from the zero mode integral. So the introduction of entanglement boundary and the entanglement boundary condition has added this subleading term to our entanglement entropy, which is sensitive to those boundary conditions. Actually, are there any questions so far? Yeah.
So the boundary condition, that this Ebrian boundary condition seems to be invariant under the duality, which is the radius of the compact.
I was just about to say this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then I'll let you say it.
Okay. Yeah. So there is a puzzle here. So I mentioned there are two choices. There was a Dirichlet plane and Neumann. So what about Neumann? So suppose you take this plane with a hole and you put Neumann boundary conditions here. Now you can check that Neumann boundary conditions, as opposed to Dirichlet one, actually preserves the shift symmetry. There's no problem with shifting phi now. And because of that, these correlation functions are preserved in the sense that these have a momentum conserving delta function that is there precisely because of the shift invariance of phi. So no problems with these things. Fusion rules are preserved. All the bulk local operators seem to be preserved up to order epsilon as we want. So there's a puzzle here, because if that's true, then we don't need to sum over anything. We just fix Neumann boundary conditions on the whole. And that would satisfy our Ebrian boundary condition. But that is too quick, because that misses some non-local operators. So you can't see in this frame. These local vertex operators make up half of these primaries of the free boson. There's another half, which are vortex operators. They create vortices of phi. And they're non-local in this frame. To see them as local operators, you have to make a t-duality transformation. T-duality maps a Neumann to a Dirichlet boundary condition. But it maps this phi to a phi tilde, where the radius now is different. The r tilde is like 1 over r. On this t-dual frame, you will find now that these local operators, e tilde, which were non-local with respect to the original frame. These things would have been the vortex operators of this original frame. Now they look like the electric operators, or electric operators in this frame. And to preserve these correlation functions, you now have to sum over phi tilde at this circle. But what is phi tilde back in the original frame? It was actually the Wilson, what I call the Wilson line variable in this original frame, is actually the Dirichlet parameter in the t-dual frame. So this tells you that you can't get away without summing if you want to preserve t-duality. And more importantly, if you want to preserve all the correlation functions of all operators, including the non-local ones. Does that answer your question, or is it related?
I think so. I guess what I wanted to ask about, though, was, okay, so this is sort of establishing that the boundary condition is invariant, but it looked like the expression you wrote for the entropy, at least the subleading term, this log of r squared, doesn't look like it's invariant.
No, you should get a t-dual, because, wait, what do you mean? It depends what you mean by invariance. I mean, it's covariant, because r goes to 1 over r. So this expression also goes to 1 over r.
So if I wrote that same thing with 1 over r, I would get I'd have a different entropy, I guess is what I'm saying, in the different frames.
Yes, I think that's right. That's also the result of Ben Michel and Chernivsky's calculation, that you get the t-dual entanglement entropy. Yeah.
So it's a different number?
Yes.
Okay.
The subleading term to the entanglement entropy is a different number. Okay, but I think one has to be a little bit careful here, because if you were to compare, if you compare this theory and it's t-dual, I think you will get different expressions with respect to r tilde. You will get, right? I'm actually confused by this one. Let me try to answer this maybe at the end of the talk.
I think that's correct. I think the partition function transforms non-trivially on duality, and so the entanglement entropy should too. And I think probably your formula is just reflecting. So I think
I think
that's the right answer.
I know that's the result as well. I know this is Ben and Srinishi's result that is different. The actual entanglement trees knows the difference between the two frames. Okay, so let me just move on. So I've spoken now just about the free boson, and now I want to actually make use of this extended CFT framework to try to talk about factorization in a general CFT. So I'm going to borrow some work from Matthias Gabriel and Mark Seiberg. So more precisely, we had this open sort of string pair of pants where we can split an interval into two using the E-brain boundary condition. And we know that this corresponds to some kind of closed string pair of pants via an unfolding trick. And I wanted to study this pair of pants from the point of view of CFT. In particular, I want to ask, we know this closed string of pair of pants is a describing fusion in a CFT. To what extent can fusion in CFT be described as a tensor product? So it turns out this question was asked and answered by Moore Seiberg and Gabriel maybe 20 years ago. I'm just going to go through a bit of what they did. So they, as we said earlier, mapped this pair of pants to this plane with three holes, or three circles. So there are three Hilbert spaces here. It's H1, H2, and H3. And what they wanted to do was to derive a curve product formula. So we can consider this big circle. And we said before, a circle has a whole tower of states that are built by these Hasmuti generators. But we want to relate the states on this big circle to the states on the two smaller circles. And that will take the form of a curve product formula, because this Jn acting on the base big circle is going to get mapped to some Js acting on the small circles via contour deformation. So more precisely, we're going to imagine here we've inserted a primary operator sine phi at these two punctures, omega 1 and omega 2. What we want to ask is, we want to do this integral. What is this integral telling us? It's telling us how do this tensor product obtained by inserting psi and phi transform under Jn. This is sort of like the thing you would compute when you compute the word identity to see how these states transform. So this integral Zn of J of Z is just a way of writing Jn here, right? Because this Jn is defined about the point z equal to 0. And now when I do this contour integral around this big circle, I can deform it into the two smaller circles. For n positive, I don't have to, there are potentially three poles. But for n positive, there's only two poles, one at W1, one at W2. Where do these poles come from? These poles come from the fact that once I deform this contour around these two points, I can use the OPE of J either with psi at omega 1 or J with phi at omega 2. And in that OPE expansion, I'll find singularities at these two points. And the contour integral will pick up those singularities. But when I do that contour integral, what I'm going to get is, because I've applied the OPEs, I'm going to see an operator J acting on psi and operator J acting on phi. And that will give me a co-product formula of this form. So what I read is delta 1 of Jn here is really a Kasmudi generator that lives on this circle. And here delta 2 is the Kasmudi generator living on that circle. And it's important that the Kasmudi generator on the big circle is actually non-trivially related to the Kasmudi generator on these other circles, because they're not centered on the same point. So in any case, if you do this kind of integral for n positive, for the positive nodes, you find this kind of co-product formula. This Jn on the big circle can be expressed as a tensor product of operators on these two smaller circles. So this is the kind of thing you would expect if you want to write H3, which is the Hilbert space on the big circle, as a tensor product of H1 times H2. You want to write the operators as tensor products as well. But there's something highly non-trivial about this tensor product. And you notice this when you compute the delta, the co-product for negative modes. When n is negative, there is now a pole at zero. So we have to pick up that pole at zero as well as we deform the contour. But now there's a choice. I could have picked up this pole at zero by using the OP of j with the puncture omega 1. If I do that, I'll get one co-product called delta, which I've colored blue. And I get this expression here. But I could have done the same calculation. But instead of using the operator product expansion of j with omega 1, I use the OP of j with omega 2 to pick up the pole at 0. If I do that, I get a different co-product, which has the two factors interchanged. In fact, I put them side by side here. And you can see the two co-products look similar, except you see this is omega 1 jm times 1. Here, this is omega 2 1 times jm, meaning the rows of omega 1 and omega 2 are reversed. Now, in order for this co-product formula to be consistent, because we could have done the OP in either way, those two expressions must be the same somehow. But they're not manifestly the same. I mean, the formulas look asymmetric and look different. So how can they be the same? They can be the same only if we take a quotient of the tensor product of H1 times H2. We choose the largest quotient such that these two co-product formulas are equal. And when you do this, it restores the symmetry of the co-product between the two factors. And moreover, so this co-product formula looks complicated, but it's sort of what needs to happen in order for the level or the central charge of the Casimirian algebra to be preserved. What I mean by this is if you just did the most naive thing and you really took a tensor product of two these Hilbert spaces on these two circles, then the central charge or the level would actually add. And that's not what you want here, right? That wouldn't be fusing two circles into one or splitting one to two. And that's also not what happens in CFT fusion rules, right? In CFT fusion, the level is preserved as you go from states here into the states there. So let me pause here, because this is sort of a subtle point. And so at the moment, I'm just reproducing what Gabriel and Moore Seiberg discussed. Are there any questions about this? So essentially, they have given us for free a tensor product interpretation of fusion. And I want to use that to give I want to translate that into factorization in the context of entanglements. So how do we borrow their story into ours? So in our story, so this is the picture I drew earlier for the free boson. It's supposed to, if this K here were the vacuum state, this is the factorization diagram for the vacuum state on two intervals. But now I want to think about a general theory, not just a free boson. But we're going to assume there are still these Casimirian symmetries. And I'm going to borrow the technique of contour deformation from Gabriel and Matthias. So here, I put an arbitrary primary at a point near infinity here. And I want to reinterpret this diagram in terms of a three punctured plane, or a plane with three holes. So I do this conformal map. So this eta plane here maps this purple circle to this little semicircle. It takes one of my half lines to the semicircle at infinity and the other half line to the semicircle near the origin. And now, as we mentioned earlier, I can unfold the Casimirian charges on these segments onto these Casimirian charges on these circles here. So this picture here is the unfolded version of this picture. And now I can go step by step, just exactly do what Gabriel did. I take the charge defined on this purple circle, and I deform it onto the blue and the red. When I do that, doing the same integral I showed earlier, I get a co-product formula that tells me how to represent charges on this purple circle in terms of charges on the blue and the red. And again, it has this form with the binomial coefficients, like in the previous slide. One point I would make here is that these operators with M positive are annihilation, and these are creation. So this looks something like a Boglubov transformation, and to understand this formula, I want to compare it to a Boglubov transformation. So how do I do that? I'm going to start with this purple contour here, which we're computing to get the code product, and I'm going to deform it onto the real axis. And along the real axis, this is a slice this real section here is a real section that Minkowski space also has in common. So it will be this t equals 0 line here. And so I can ask, how does this factorization work in Minkowski space? What if I had a free boson, say, here, phi, say the right moving part of a free boson on Minkowski space? And I can naturally expand the field on a t equals 0 slice in terms of the oscillators, creation annihilation operators. And I can ask, well, I can also expand the same field in terms of Rindler modes, which are oscillators, I shouldn't say oscillators, just a basis of modes on the left and on the right. This basis I'm going to write on the t equals 0 slice as x to the ik, with some theta function that forces it to be on the left side or on the right side. But if you write x in terms of the Rindler coordinate c, and you put x back here, you can see that this x to the ik is really a plane wave in Rindler coordinates. So it's a similar kind of expansion here. And now this equation here, I can, if I look at the overlap integral of this plane wave e to the ipx with this Rindler mode x to ik, I can get the Boglubov transformation between ap and alpha left k and alpha right k. If you do that calculation, you get some equation like this. It tells you that how to write the Minkowski annihilation operator in terms of the annihilation and creation operators of the Rindler modes. So I want to ask you, what does this formula have to do with this formula? This is a bunch of binomial coefficients. This is a bunch of things, gamma functions, right? So I'm going to claim they're the same. But the argument is going to be a bit delicate. So it goes. So first, I'm going to take the limit of epsilon being very small. So the parameter u in the previous couple of slides ago is actually minus 1. And now the code product formula takes this form. It is more or less symmetric between the left and right, except for this minus sign here. And now I'm going to consider the case of high, I'm going to consider Jn, which is this charge we're trying to factorize, with n very, very large. So why do I want to take the large n limit? Because I want to interpret this integrand here that defines my Jn as an exponential function. And that can only work if I take n to be infinity, and also I deform the contour to a region where eta goes to 0. When I do that, the binomial coefficient takes a particular form. When n is much bigger than q, in this n choose q here, it can be expressed as a gamma function of this form. The next step is I'm going to make a wake rotation to rotate these indices to imaginary indices. The reason is that if I take these charges jm, jq, which I define on the left and the right here, sorry, I define them on the eta plane, which is on these circles here. If I map them back from the eta plane back to the z plane, which is this geometry here, I see that I get an integral that looks like I'm picking out a particular mode of j on the z plane, but this mode has an imaginary mode number. Similarly here, this minus iq here is imaginary mode number. So when I go from the eta plane back to the z plane, I'm making some kind of wick rotation. So if I do those wick rotation, now my binomial coefficient looks more familiar. When I do the wick rotation, I get precisely this expression. And finally, so now I'm going to rewrite my code product. I've chosen n to be very large, but much bigger than m, much bigger than q. I would rotate it, so I get these binomial coefficients have been transformed. And now I also am careful to write down I'm going to group together this ik here with the Kasputi charge jik. The reason is that the relation between jik and the alpha ks, between the rindermost, is precisely by this factor of 1 over ik, because j is really d phi. So j was d phi, so when you take d phi, it brings down a factor of ik here. So once I do all these steps, I see a very nice match between the co-product formula, which was derived by contour definition, and the Lulabov transformation. Oh, geez. So actually, that was my last real substance slide. So I have 5 minutes left to give the conclusion. But before I do that, are there any questions?
Okay.
Yeah.
I missed what the significance of this parameter n. So you compared the two when n is large, but should they be true at all values? Sorry, what?
Well, the thing is, this is a discrete formula.
Yes.
And this is a continuous one. Also, there's an issue that I started with a contour up here, right? The definition of the charge defined up here was in terms of this integral. Whereas the if I wanted to know what this AP is, if by the Fourier transform it defines AP, it would be integral of a plane wave, right? It would be integral minus IPX times phi. So for those two integrals to look the same, I had to do some massaging, right?
Is it just that you're switching from this sort of finite disk? Like, is it somehow going from this finite disk picture to this sort of infinite Minkowski space picture?
That's part of it. It's also to what extent was the charge I defined to begin with the same as this charge? If I think about AP as the charge, to what extent is AP the same as the charge I define as JN with N equivalent to minus IP? And to compare the two, the main thing is, can I really reinterpret this contour integral as a Fourier transform on the real line? It's not entirely obvious that I can. This thing was an integral on this little circle here in Euclidean. So this upper part of the upper half plane wasn't in the Minkowski space. It's only this real line that's has in common with Minkowski space. So I should be honest here and say that this is something a bit puzzling to me as well. We made some manipulations to match the two. I think there are some subtle questions about analytic continuation and picking out doing some like saddle point approximation of this integral. I mean, there's some oscillation here, as you can see. You see, if you write eta in terms of z, there's z to the I something. There's some oscillation here going on. So there's some subtlety here that I should say that we don't quite understand yet. Yeah. Okay, maybe I can just very quickly just conclude. So we propose a way of extending 2D CFTs to incorporate this entanglement brain boundary condition. We propose that the entanglement brain is de facto vacuum Ishibashi state. Essentially, we want to say the factorization of the Hilbert space can be done using the co-product formula of very similar to Gabriel and Morse-Seiberg. In terms of cobordism, we're saying that this cobordism basically factorizes the state. We start with a state, say the vacuum state on this line, and it's defined by Jn positive annihilating it. So that the solution to that equation is the state I call omega, which is given by this macaroni. And if I want to factorize a general excited state, I just use a co-product formula obtained by contour deformation. And I can build all the excited states on top of this interval by using the co-product. So this equation here is factorizing for each excited state on the left on this interval. I write it in terms of an excited state in terms of these two intervals. I want to maybe skip some of these comments with one exception, which is that for people here in the math community, there's something called the confusion, of bimodules over phenomenon algebras is something that these authors discuss. And one thing that is still a puzzle to me is whether the kind of tensor product factorization I described has something to do with this confusion. The likely answer is yes, but the language of the confusion is a bit too formal for me, so I don't know for sure. This is important because there's an unpublished work by Siegel that applies this confusion to this something like a tensor factorization for general QFTs. So making connection between our notion of tensor factorization to the confusion may have some rewards in terms of generalizations. But I want to also briefly describe I want to really indulge in speculations about applications. One is that these cobordisms I described might have something to do with tensor networks. If I imagine that this open string pair of pants is like a coarse graining tensor, and this 2-to-2 scattering open string is like a disentangler, then we can take our state on the circle and split it into an interval, split it into two intervals, coarse grain, disentangle, coarse grain, disentangle, et cetera, et cetera. And this evolution, which doesn't change the state because of our entanglement boundary condition, looks very much like a tensor network. This may have something to do with this story about BC bits of Ramstorff. There, he was trying to consider the holographic dual of a CFT on a hemisphere like this, where little semicircles have been dug into the circle here. And these semicircles are very much, I think, the same as these semicircles here. And in fact, this idea of tensor networks via cobordisms, I think, might be somewhat implied by some recent work of Takinagi. If I think of this open pair of pants, rather than this geometry, I put it into geometry like this with a slit, which is something that one finds in string theory textbooks. This geometry looks very much like a local quench. And Takinagi noticed that in a paper that studied holographic duals to local quench in the boundary CFT, that they were getting something in the bulk dual to the local quench. It looks very much like this picture here. There are some constant time slice of the bulk where there are these slits inserted. And he wanted to interpret these slits in terms of a tensor network. And this picture, I think, may be a way to make that precise. And the last comment I will make is that part of this work was motivated by the interest in entanglement in string theory. There's an old story there that if I just put a conical deficit in space-time and calculate string theory diagrams in that space-time and assume that that computes for me entanglement entropy, I actually get something quite nice. I can recover, for example, the area over 4G Newton that's associated with Beckenstein-Hawking entropy by computing a closed string diagram, the sphere diagram in this space-time. This is a story of Susskind and Ugbom. But what's missing from that story is interpretation in terms of state counting. Because this closed string diagram is not obviously computing trace over a Hilbert space. But if I reinterpret the closed string diagram in terms of an open string diagram, then it looks like a one loop trace over open string Hilbert space. So that's a very appealing idea. But to make that precise, when I consider this closed string diagram moving in a space-time with a conical singularity represented by this line here, it's going to get punctured by this line many, many times. And in order to get a whole open string interpretation, I have to interpret the punctures as some kind of holes developing on the world sheet. But these holes very much have to be like the holes created by the entangling surface because they weren't there to begin with, so we must be able to close them up. So our E-brain boundary condition in the CFT might have something to say about the E-brain boundary condition on the world sheet. And perhaps this can tell us something about factorization in string theory. So I think that's the last thing I'll say. Thanks again for asking.
Great. Are there any questions for Gabriel?
On the first conclusion slide, there was one point that you couldn't comment on because for time reason, and the point was about explicit understanding of the quotient of the tensor product. I just wondered what you meant.
Well, so I mentioned that the entangling product involves a quotient.
Yeah.
But I didn't say explicitly whether it's exactly the same as the quotient that Gaboriau and Moore-Seiberg were talking about. So that's something that's still a bit of a puzzle to us. The quotient that I mentioned was very indirectly defined. It was defined by saying two expressions are the same.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's rather, but then it'd be nice to actually, if you could just explicitly tell me for SU2 level K, what is that quotient? What am I doing to the space of states to get this quotient? Is the thermal field double-like state that I wrote down for the free boson living in the quotient? I mean, all these things in so far is implicit, but it's not really, we don't have a very explicit understanding.
And you don't have anything like a group action to control it, or as it's just a kind of a formally defined quotient in the sense of, okay, that's what you need to do. But it's not like, oh, I have this group acting on it, and it's natural to ask invariants, and then I get a quotient or something like that.
In Gaboriau's formulation, there's not an obvious group action, right? It's just about OPE. But in our formulation, there is a group action because you see here, we have to match the Dirichlet boundary conditions, right, on this point and that point. But you can think, well, that why does it have to happen? Because there's a U1 actor on either side. Remember, the phis are invariant under shift. If I want an invariant under simultaneous shifts of the right and the left region by the same shift, then I have to match by epsilon on either side and the sum of them. So this is precisely what I mean. So this sounds like some kind of a quotient, but a priori, it doesn't sound like it has anything to do with Gaboriau's quotient. So maybe there are many quotients going on, and maybe they're not related. We're still puzzled about that.
All right, any other questions? Okay, let's thank Gabriel again.